So today I'll talk instead about what, I mean, at least give a small review on what we know about a possible experimental test of a dynamical Casimir effect. And this is in the same line of considering quantum vacuum as a non-trivial medium, like any condensed matter system medium. So you can have polarization of this medium, like of the effects related to renormalization of charge, mass, and so on, in QED, for instance, dispersion, dissipation. And from this point of view, the focus is more on quantum vacuum as a viscous medium. And in particular, one of the striking phenomena from this point of view is that if you have a mirror moving in quantum vacuum, there are predictions that if this motion is non-uniform in acceleration, so you have a dot different from zero, there will be a damping force. You can always compare this with a more concrete example of a body in a fluid, which will experience instead a damping force if it's just in motion. Okay? So you have a force proportional to the velocity. In this case, this damping force is proportional to a dot. Even if you move with the constant acceleration, you should have no damping force. So, in some sense, this means that from this point of view, it's natural to consider motion with constant acceleration. If you have an acceleration which is not constant, the system will dissipate energy. Okay? And again, you can compare with the situation of motional states. If, for instance, you leave a sphere dropping in a fluid, you'll have motion at zero velocity or constant velocity if you have a uniform force field for
But is it not just that you have a charged or some, well, at least microscopically charged object that you accelerate and then you get radiation by?
No, this is a neutral object. Eh? I mean,
Yeah,
it's
but
just a
it's not neutral on the microscopic scale or fluctuations there are. I mean, and so it's just the classical explanation that you produce photons, on-shell photons, that carry away energy.
But no real photons, only virtual photons. It's a bit bizarre phenomenon.
No, I think there should be real photons.
At T0?
No, if you accelerate.
Yeah, you can also adopt. Now I'm looking to this effect from the, let's say, Casimir point of view, where you have a perfect reflector moving in vacuum. Okay? You can always make a parallel with the Lifshitz approach, where you have this piece of material, we call mirror, with microscopic dipoles, and if they are accelerating, but then also if they are just accelerating, you don't need a dot. Even if you have a different from zero, you'll have dipole radiation. This is a specific. There can be a relation to what was in the old days of classical electrodynamics, the radiation reaction, the Abraham-Lorentz equation, but it's not directly related. It's not the usual dipole irradiation due to Bremsstrahlung in some sense from dipoles, due to the constant acceleration. Here, if you have a constant acceleration, you don't have any irradiation of this kind. Okay? So, from this perspective, it seems like if a quantum vacuum has a privileged frame of reference, with respect, you can accelerate the particles and you can see if they emit radiation or not. So, if a motion in this kind of frame of reference is non-uniform accelerated, they will dissipate. Okay? There are a lot of people who have contributed in this direction. This is relevant because it's a first attempt to relate quantum field theory with relativity. So, how this is related to the Casimir effect? Well, first of all, there is a mirror. Okay? And so the idea is that from the point of view of the last seminar, if you have a cavity with two, for instance, parallel plates, if now instead of considering a static situation where the two plates are at rest, you are moving one of the two plates, if a motion is very slow, nothing happens other than to have a AC component of a force in superposition to DC force. But if the motion is fast enough and comparable to the wavelengths in the cavity, or the optical cavity, then the energy can be released from phononic energy of this vibration can be released into real photons. So if you have, in other words, from a little bit more formal point of view, if you have time-dependent boundary conditions which are not adiabatic, so are not slow enough, you can have a dissipative force from a point of view, because if you have an harmonic oscillation, obviously you have all the derivatives of the position, and so also a dot different from zero. But instead of looking to the dissipation in the harmonic oscillator schematizing, for instance, one of these two plates, you can just look directly to the photon emission. If it's a dissipative force, it should emit photons in this case. And from this point of view, it's like if virtual photons in quantum vacuum are promoted to be real photons through interaction with the phonons of a vibrational mode. It seems important, if you do the calculation just, for instance, for a mirror which is in motion, in principle, this mirror alone is already radiating, but the chance to see this effect are nearly zero. So it's important to be in a cavity, and it's even better to be in a high finesse electromagnetic cavity, because you can pile up these photons in time. Please? No. Okay. So there have been various discussions on how we can detect this effect. Astrid Lambrecht and Serge Reynaud in 1996 gave a first quantitative assessment of the situation in terms of an electromagnetic cavity. There is an alternative approach based on the fact that since what matters from the electromagnetic point of view is just not moving mechanically a mirror, but to move the charges which are responsible for a reflection, meaning the electrons, you can even imagine an approach in which, this was first pioneered by Lotzovic, Jablonovic, and so on, in which instead you move the charge carriers. It's not a physical motion, it's a wave, or a plasma kind of motion, in the sense that you can take, for instance, a semiconductor, shine a pulse or laser on the semiconductor, and the semiconductor from being a semiconductor can become a conductor, and then for some thickness, for a larger thickness than before shining the laser, and then you can have an effective motion of a conductor, and so an effective change of the boundary conditions. Victor Dodonov and collaborators have also proposed the use of Rydberg atoms, and some time ago in the meeting held in Oklahoma in 2003, I also sketched the proposal using micro nano resonators and hyperfine states, and I'll discuss a little bit more in detail the follow-up of this idea and this proposal, which is actually turning out into a real experiment now going on in Legnaro, near Padova. So this is a sketch of what is going on from a cartoon point of view, taken from the experiment going on in Legnaro and sponsored by the National Institute of Nuclear Physics. So the idea is that you can generate photons just shaking a cavity. Okay? It can also be seen from the quantum optics point. You can see this effect from the many points of view, depending on the community you belong. If you are a quantum optician, or you like those techniques, you will see this as a parametric conversion of real photons starting from virtual photons through quantum vacuum. And so it's very similar to a kind of acoustic optical modulation, but starting with virtual photons instead of real photons. If you like more of a field theory approach, you can just say that you are creating particles changing boundary condition in vacuum. And this is important because, in principle, we can have a tabletop experiment testing some conditions which will never create in the lab otherwise, like creation of particles due to curvature space-time and so on at the beginning of the universe. So it's the closest thing we can imagine in the lab to test these kind of ideas on the creation of particles, not only photons, like in this case, at the beginning of the universe. Or you can just take also the approach of people who want to try to merge or to see contradiction in the merging between quantum theory and relativity in general, of trying to see what are the predictions for relativity in quantum vacuum. Okay. No, there is no conceptual difference. In fact, for instance, this paper by Astrid Lambrecht and Serge Reynaud, they discuss both the case of just one or two moving out of phase, or even moving in phase, and there is a production of photons. Because what matters is that you are moving with respect to this kind of heater, this quantum vacuum. Okay? I had some problems to imagine that we have a privileged frame of reference, but if you think, for instance, of a cosmic background radiation, it's similar. There is a privileged frame of reference which cosmic background radiation is isotropic, and for instance, we are not in this system, you see the dipole anisotropy in that case. So
if you have a constant, if you're boxed with constant velocity, versus you would probably. You need acceleration, otherwise it
won't work. Not only acceleration, I say, you need the change in acceleration, because...
But the movement relative to the microwave background would not produce photons.
But in that case you see a Doppler shift with respect. The fact that we are moving with respect to this uniform background of photons, you will see a Doppler shift in different directions, right? Like it is the dipole anisotropy or cosmic background radiation is just this. It's just a Doppler shift effect. Again, we have to disentangle here between Doppler shift, like in that case, just tells you that we are moving with respect to this frame of reference in which the cosmic background radiation is isotropic, completely isotropic. Here we are speaking about not even just accelerating bodies. If this box is moving with uniform acceleration, nothing happens. So there is no. There will be dipole irradiation, as we were discussing before, but not this kind of radiation. This only happens when you have an acceleration which is changing in time. If you have an harmonic motion, obviously you take all the derivative, you always have all the possible a dot, a double dot, and so on. It will be. Actually, I had always problems, and I still have problems, to understand the second law of dynamics, or Newton, and why the motion is locked to the second derivative of a position. I mean, acceleration is, in some sense, probably this is related to that stuff, okay? In the sense, if you think, from a mathematical point of view, there is no reason for which if you have a motion at time t plus delta t, this should be determined by time at t, at instant time t, and then you should know position, the velocity, and the acceleration. In principle, from the mathematical point of view, you should have a Taylor expansion. You should have all the possible derivatives. So it's always a mystery that, as a student, we have to digest, that just knowing position, initial velocity, and then the force, you can sum all these Taylor expansion in some sense.
But it's probably an effective theory.
Hmm?
I mean, you basically.
I think we are getting too philosophical.
Yes, yes. We can discuss later, anyway, either in this plenary discussion later. But my point is that there is a relationship probably between inertia, the Abraham-Lorentz force, and this dynamical Casimir radiation. Okay, that is still kind of unexplored. Anyway, if you are in a one-dimensional case. Suppose to have a one-dimensional electromagnetic cavity, there is, in that case, the modes of a cavity are degenerate. So if you create photons, for instance, the first mode of a cavity, they are going to populate also the other modes of a cavity. And then you don't have a strong growth. It's just linear in time. It's better to use a case of a 3D cavity in which you have degeneracy between the various modes of a cavity. In that case, you can have an exponential growth. This has been studied in detail for various models, one-dimensional, three-dimensional, scalar field, vector field, and so on. And pretty much most of the models in the realistic case of a three-dimensional cavity converge on the fact that you have an exponential increase in the number of photons created, which can be written in this way. And here you have here the initial number of photons. If you have thermal photons in the cavity, this will be the average number of thermal photons. If you have cooled down the system and you have just the 0 point photons, the average half a photon expected for a particular model, here you'll have an average value of 1/2. Okay, so it's just a parametric amplification from this point of view of what is inside the cavity. If there is on average half a photon, that half a photon will be exponentially amplified. And this is a dynamics with T. Obviously, if you have a cavity with a finite electrical quality factor, this doesn't go forever, but is going to saturate because then the cavity will leak. And roughly, this can be obtained by considering the loading time of a cavity, which is its quality factor divided by the frequency. Little omega here is the frequency, the angular frequency of the cavity. And this is big omega is the mechanical modulation. Okay? And I imagine now an experiment in which I am driving one of the two walls, or both walls, at this big omega frequency. And the first mode of a cavity, for instance, is corresponding to little omega frequency. And the relation is a factor 2, like, for instance, in the degenerate parametric amplification. Then you plug this inside here, and this is the important quantity. Your amplification is determined by the dissipation in the cavity, and this epsilon, which is the ratio, can be written both as a ratio between the peak velocity of a wall with respect to the speed of light, V over C, or you can also express as the displacement amplitude of a wall with respect to the cavity gap, I mean, the distance between the two walls itself. And as you see, it's very sensitive. Q epsilon, if you choose 1/2, 1 or 2, gives you as a final number of photons in the cavity after this parametric amplification differences by one order of magnitude each. Okay? So the hope to see directly to drive this cavity, even with this large Q and epsilon, and some epsilon alone, is a kind of slim, because even if, for instance, if I consider a case with epsilon of the order of Q to minus 1, which is already a stretch from the experimental point of view, the expected power is kind of small. You can calculate this putting this n number of saturated photons due to a dynamic cosmic effect. There, energy h bar omega divided by the time tau, the loading time in the cavity, you get a power which is of the order of 10 to minus 22 watts, which is kind of difficult to measure in the microwave range. In this case, for as we'll see, the idea is to have microwave cavities, because it's very difficult to drive at higher frequency mechanically object. So you can hope to do at most gigahertz. So the experimental scheme we have.
I'm sure this is obvious to everyone else in the room. Where is the dissipated part of the response on the walls? And does that get subtracted somehow? Here's what's in the vacuum here, and what's happening in these poor walls that have to be pushed.
So they are driven, even if there is dissipation, because they feel these.
So your real charge is trying to maintain the boundary condition.
Yes, yes. So it's driven. Yeah. The fact that you are driving some power is also to compensate
the material property comes into the answer or not? It seems that there is a frequency dependence in the material property. How's it showing up?
In what sense?
In the sense that the material is responding differently to this applied displacement.
There will be dissipations inside the material, you mean?
Yeah, and how does one know this is not the big part of it?
Meaning that they can dissipate phonons. This is part of the problem. This is a possible source of background. I'll comment on this, because whatever you are going to drive, that will dissipate and introduce
so
photons.
Is there some kind of back-of-the-envelope a priori estimate from normal?
there are envelopes. For instance, if you use, as I'll discuss later, these F-bar resonators, these are Filmberg acoustic resonators, with driving of this order of magnitude, with a quality factor of a cavity of 10 to the 8, for instance, you can have, to have one, you should have a 10 to minus 8 of amplitude of this squeezing factor V over C. And that corresponds to some watts of dissipation in driving a system, considering the quality factor of a material. Yeah. And this, in principle, can be an issue. Yeah.
Can you just remind us quickly what determines the quality factor and what are the important parameters?
The quality factor here of a cavity? This is a good question for
help. Do you operate with superconducting cavities?
Or? You, 10 to the 8 has been obtained but this is a proposal.
10 to the 8 is really, I know for microwave cavities, 10 to the 6 is already that's quite good.
There are two examples, the group of, I think, Gerd Rempe and Walter, when he was alive, achieved something like 10 to the 9.
10 to the 9.
Yeah. And also Serge Roche has used the high quality, very high quality. Yes. So it's feasible. The issue is that it's feasible also introducing the things we have to introduce here to see the effect. But in itself, it has been achieved something like 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 in superconducting cavities. But
and I guess nothing was. All the optical properties, dissipation, plasma frequency are summarized in some sense in the quality factor.
Yes.
Probably
what
you want. Yeah. Oh, that's okay.
Yeah. So the scheme, from this point of view, which can overcome this mismatch in the sensitivity of any possible detection scheme, is the following. So you have the cavity, and you drive one of the two walls of the cavity, and you produce these Casimir photons. Okay. Meanwhile, you prepare cold atoms, and in the upper manifold of an hyperfine state. Now, for alkali atoms, so the hyperfine states are particularly, coincidentally, they have frequency splittings which are of the order of gigahertz. For instance, I'll give some frequencies I can anticipate here. For instance, the hyperfine splitting. In the case of sodium 23, which has been cooled down even to Bose-Einstein condensation, it's 1.77 gigahertz. And rubidium is 6 gigahertz. The famous cesium used for atomic clock is almost 10 gigahertz. Lithium is 228 megahertz, as you see. So the idea is to exploit these hyperfine splittings to detect these small amount of photons. So first you invert the population. Here the inversion is indicated with this double circle in some sense. And then you send, for instance, with an optical tweezer inside the cavity, these atoms. And then you detect there is a phenomenon called the superradiance inside this cavity going on. And this corresponds to compress the decay of the atoms in the lower manifold of a hyperfine state in a very short time. And this boosts a lot of the power which can be obtained as a result of this. And so you can either detect now directly with an antenna. This could perturb the cavity because you have to do, in order to have some decent detection angle, you have to perturb the geometry of the cavity. Or you can just interrogate the population of the atoms which are then removed from the cavity and go to see how many have decayed into the lower state of the hyperfine through the hyperfine transition. Okay? So the idea. Then it's summarized here. The mechanical resonators so far can be obtained with up to a few gigahertz, but these are just the range of the hyperfine splitting in the alkali atoms. The lifetime in the excited level is very important, though. Okay? If you just take an atom and you put in the excited state of the hyperfine transition, that will stay a very long time, order of thousands of years in this hyperfine transition. An example is the 21 centimeter for hydrogen, which is observed, for instance, by people working in radio astronomy. So, and this is the relation between the lifetime and the magnet, Bohr magneton, and all the other properties. Here, this is the difference between the two energy levels, hyperfine energy levels. Now, if you put the same atom inside the cavity, you have Purcell effect. So, actually, you boost up the speed of decay. And for instance, if you have a quality factor, kind of target quality factor, benchmark quality factor of 10 to the 8, the natural lifetime of a cavity is reduced to something like 1,100,000 seconds, more reasonable. This is just the relation between what happens in terms of lifetime of a cavity with respect to what you have in free space. And there is a boosting, a speed up of the decay just due to the effect of a cavity. Now, the super radiance helps even further because you have a further amplification, acceleration, if you want, of this decay, which is measured by this decay in the cavity divided by the number of atoms. I don't know if I have to summarize briefly what is super radiance, but it's a kind of collective effect, like is the counterpart of a spontaneous emission by a single atom when you have. You take into account the presence of other atoms together. In that case, you no longer have an exponential decay, but the decay of the atoms in this collective state is a sort of burst, which has a time, a duration of the order of the original decay in the spontaneous decay divided by a number of atoms. So this is, in some sense, is a collective spontaneous emission effect. And in this way, you can boost up the power just because everything happens through the amplification due to the atoms and through this superradiant time by something like 10 to minus 13 watts. You can notice from what I wrote before that this effect, like many coherent effects, is proportional to the square of the number of atoms because the superradiant time in turns depend on the number of atoms in the denominator. So as you expect for coherent phenomena, this is proportional to the square of the number of atoms. And this is pretty much under control in terms of sensitivity because there are microbolometers in that range with this spectral power density for their sensitivity. Okay, they are already operating. Now, there is a first background that one has to take into account. Obviously, these catastrophic decay of the superradiance can be induced by an external agent, but it can also just due to the fact that one atom decides spontaneously to decay itself and then triggers the catastrophic event. So you have to compete with what is called the spontaneous triggering of superradiance or superfluorescence. And one way to disentangle between the two is the fact that in that case you have just the half photon or one photon of a single atom decaying. In the case with a cavity with cosmic photons inside, you have maybe 10 times that number. And so just looking to the delay with which the superradiant pulse occurs, you can disentangle between these two. Okay, so this is actually has been demonstrated in another frequency range by the Arosh group a long time ago. Otherwise, the other possibility, since this is a kind of kinematic experiment, is just that you move the atoms out of cavity before the superfluorescence takes place. I mean, superfluorescence is slightly occurring on a longer time scale, as you can see here. And it's actually better not to have too much atoms from this point of view. So the bottleneck on the maximum number of atoms is coming from here, because otherwise you have to wait too much. And these are, for instance, the experiments done in the Arosh group, in which you see this superradiant event. And there is an initial trigger here, and you see that the delay with which the separation between the peak of the superradiant peak and the superradiant peak and the trigger depends on the number of atoms of photons injected into the cavity. So, as I was mentioning, possible candidates for these are the alkali atoms, which have hyperfine states in the range between 100 megahertz and 10 gigahertz, what is the advantage of this? That you have a cavity which is kind of short. For instance, in this case, you just need 1.6 centimeter cavity. Okay, so you are working higher frequency. In principle, it's even better because another possible background are the black body radiation photons inside the cavity. Always, this tells you if you have to operate at liquid helium temperature, for instance, or 10 millikelvin and so on. But the problem is that it's very hard to have now to use this frequency. You need then a Michaelian modulation at something like 18 gigahertz. 18 gigahertz is still out of reach. Okay, first. And second, you need 18 gigahertz with a given amplitude, so 10 to minus 8 in terms of V over C, which is roughly also the amplitude, the displacement amplitude with respect to the length of cavity. No way for now. This gives rise to a very long cavity. This is corresponding to a cavity of 65 centimeters, as you see. And that is also very difficult because then this also means that very small black body radiation inside the cavity, and you have to cool down even. And these are the examples of these critical time scales that you need. So this is the lifetime in free space for the magnetic dipole transition, okay, in the hyperfine state. As you see, it's very, very long. This is what you obtain if you put the same atoms inside the cavity with an electrical quality factor of 10 to V8, so you gain a huge factor, order of 10 orders of magnitude. If you use a super radiance with something like 10 to V8, 10 to V7 atoms inside the cavity, you will get a time of order of 10 milliseconds. Okay? If there are no photons inside the cavity. If there are photons inside the cavity, and I think this is calculated for something like 10 photons, Casimir photons, you have a reduction in terms of duration of this delay of this super radiant pulse of the order of 2 milliseconds. And these are the Casimir power, original Casimir power, the one you get with the super radiant effect. So the best of the two worlds in this case seems to be obtained using sodium, because you can drive a mechanical object at 3.4 gigahertz, and at the same time, most of these parameters have been obtained independently in different experiments, including cold atoms with the super radiance effect already seen.
What's more the signal then? The small difference between time?
Yeah, I mean, one experiment you can do is the following. You don't drive you don't drive a cavity in the first place, okay? I think it's better. Yeah, just the one. So you have a cavity here, and this is driven from outside, can be driven, and you put the atoms. And the atoms are going inside, and you see this super radiant pulse with some delay, and you don't drive a cavity. So you are just studying the background, the superfluorescence. Then you drive a cavity, supposedly, hopefully you have more photons, and this will be delayed a little bit. Oh, well, obviously, there is a broadening also, so you have always a probability that you are assigning the wrong number of photons. There is a false alarm probability, if you like, but, you have to do some statistics on this, okay? To repeat the experiments and then to see the distributions in both cases.
Maybe I missed. So what's the amplitude of the... I mean, how do you calculate these numbers? Do you put in a certain amplitude for the...
Which numbers specifically?
The number of photons, say.
Yeah, the number of photons... the number of photons are coming from here, okay?
What's
N0? Yeah, N0 is, in the case of a pure ground state, is one half of the average value.
What?
Half a photon per mod. Okay? And then the total number of photons after driving the cavity will be what you have at the beginning. In general, this will be one half plus the Planck factor, 1 over E h bar t, h bar omega over kbt minus 1. This is under the condition already that you are you are not the tune. I mean, you have a mechanical frequency equal to twice the frequency of the corresponding electromagnetic mode in the cavity. If you are off, if you are out of the bandwidth of the cavity, you don't gain such effect. I mean, you are off resonance. So this is the best you can do, in other words, according to.
Okay, I'm still confused, but the other question is, I don't understand why you move the gas through the cavity.
Mm-hmm. How?
How is a different question, but why don't you put it in the cavity and then do the stuff?
Well, first of all, because I want to have a dynamical kind of measurement where I can trigger on something, first of all. Okay? So it's more experimental. Then, I mean, it's always dangerous if you have a cavity and there are atoms inside. In principle, the refractive index of the cavity is modified also. So you detune slightly. So these effects are also present when you move the atoms inside. But at least the production of photons inside is not affected. There are more hopes that you can preserve the electrical quality factor of the cavity and so on. So it would be. We think that it's much easier to first separate the preparation of your interrogation state from the production of photons, send your interrogator inside the cavity, which is already containing the gasing photons, hopefully, and then move them apart. If you start apart from the complication, because this means that you have to create a magneto-optical trap inside the electromagnetic cavity. This can be done. These days, they are merging together, cavity QAD.
You're not worried that the Q factor of the cavity will be less than you could have obtained if you didn't make all of this complicated arrangement where you move things through the cavity?
No, I think this is a reason just to have them apart when you drive a cavity for recasting photons. But you affect less the quality factor of the cavity and the refractive index and so on. In principle, a cold cloud of atoms is changing effectively the refractive index inside the cavity. So it's also detuning the cavity, in principle. So if the cavity has a quality factor large enough, you'll see a shift, and this can induce a complex dynamics.
Open is not
open, I mean, the fact that this now, I want to, the design is open just to show you. It can be also a closed cavity, apart from the...
You still need to move the...
Yeah, but this can be done without perturbing the mode of the cavity. So it's not a big issue that... Here, you show in this way, but you can imagine that it's almost completely open. Then you have holes, and the atoms are going through that. And so, but I don't think that
that
is
a major. That's a smaller perturbation, you're saying?
Yeah. So.
Our experiment was, for example, done in this way. So, cavity with two small holes, and basically, you are a smaller variation of the body function.
Okay, so now how you can drive this wall? Well, there are two possible candidates. One is to use nano-electromechanical resonators. In that case, there are relatively high mechanical quality factor. Here now, this is a mechanical quality factor of the object. Okay. And they have been produced up to kind of 1.5 gigahertz. So apart from lithium, we are still not exactly in the range. But you can imagine to have an array of nano resonators and to have them driven coherently. So you have also an issue of synchronize their motion in a coherent fashion. There are also drawbacks. Here there is a list. You can go through the list if you want, but there are quality factors. And as you see, These are the highest frequencies obtained so far for these nano-resonators. There are all the details on the material used, the dimension, and so on. And the problem is just to preserve this high frequency and also the quality factor, because if the quality factor, mechanical quality factor of this driving object is too low, you dissipate a lot. If you dissipate a lot, you have a lot of photons that in part are also entering the cavity because they are just in front of the wall. So that can be an issue. There is also, as an alternative, this technology which has been developed a lot for cellular phones in particular, these thin bulk acoustic resonators, and basically is a miniaturized version of a piezoelectric material, and it can be tuned to pretty much any frequency. Up to now they have achieved up to 8 gigahertz, and dissipated power. And these days with cellular phones, there is also a health issue, if you want, for a dissipated power in this is a few watts at most. We calculated that it should be around 5 watts for this relatively large modulation amplitude we need to drive at high frequency. They are also used in connection with biophysics, wireless communication, and so on, and this is more or less I think as of 2006 is an updated kind of review of what are the quality factor frequencies of the material. Typically they are zinc oxide or aluminum nitride and the kind of possible application. Now, from our point of view, they are going through progressive miniaturization. That's the reason the first cellular phones were kind of large and now they're very small. But we are interested to the opposite, to scale up their size, because you want to have something of square centimeters for this cavity. Okay? So that is the opposite problem, but one has to be hopeful, because this technology is going ahead in any case, regardless of the casing effect. However, there are issues, as we were already pointing out. For instance, you cannot exceed the certain area of active vibration because there can be breakdown phenomena, internal defects. So far, the size of these resonators of the order of 500 square microns, and the issue is to see, the challenge to see if you can scale up to order of square centimeter. The cavity wall is also a mechanical antenna, obviously. So, just as we were discussing before. However, this mechanical antenna should not affect the resonant mode because it's going through dipole radiation, so it's just a radiation at the frequency, or the mechanical frequency, which is already twice the frequency we want to explore from an electromagnetic point of view. And higher harmonic, so that should not be an issue. The big issue is this one, to maintain the optimal cavity quality factor when you have all these mechanical components. In particular, one of these two cavities should be made with these F-bars. So this is a big issue. And the other issue, which is important, is that if you want to start with an initial state, which is the ground state, you have to kill the thermal photons, the black body radiation photons. And this means that the initial state should contain much less thermal photons on average than casing. And at these frequencies of the order of gigahertz, this is obtained safely if you are operating around 10 millikelvin, which needs to use dilution refrigerator. So as you see, the project, I mean, it's with enough effort, money, and people, and so on, it should be kind of possible. It is really merging together nanotechnology, cold atom physics, high quality electromagnetic factors, and the cryogenic techniques together. So it's there is an alternative experimental scheme. If you want, this is in some sense a step towards the realization of the idea discussed by Astrid Lambret and Serge Reynaud 10 years before. Okay? So just to have a pure mechanical driving inside an electromagnetic cavity. The alternative idea is to pursue the approach of Yablonovich, Lozovic, and other people who think that instead of moving mechanically a cavity, one can just promote the electrons in a suitable material to become conducting or more or less conducting. So the idea is to use to have a niobium cavity here, superconducting cavity, but you don't have stringent requirements this time on the electrical quality factor for the following reason. Because on this side of a cavity, and these are courtesy of my colleague Giuseppe Ruoso, this side of a cavity you put inside a semiconductor layer. Okay? And then you shine a light through a laser, more or less uniformly through this surface. And if the frequency of a laser is large enough and you pump enough power inside, the outer layer of this semiconductor layer will start to become conducting, and so on, so that. And you can reach, they have demonstrated that you can reach order 1 millimeter in the change of the displacement, effective displacement for the cavity. So you have to 1 millimeter up to a size of a cavity order of centimeters, you can get something like 10 to minus 3, 10 to minus 4 in terms of this modulation factor epsilon. Okay? So this means that you don't need either if you have a quality factor of a cavity of 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 8 is great because you have a huge factor Q epsilon, but you can afford even a quality factor of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 3 and still have a very decent, higher than 1 product of electrical quality factor times this ratio between the velocity and the and then you directly pick up the photons, the generated photons with the antenna. The proposal has been implemented. First, they have demonstrated in this paper that you can change effectively the high frequency shining with also fast recovery time the semiconductor and change its conductive property. And the full proposal is described in this paper here. So the idea is to send then a train of pulses, okay? In some sense, this is already contained in the Yablonovich idea, or Lotzovic. But now the idea is to use the fact that is in a cavity to send a train of pulses which are synchronized with the cavity frequency and to build up and to add more and more signal in this way with a pulsed laser. So this is a neodymium lag laser, 1064 nanometers. And
okay, is the number of photons that large that you can use an antenna, or why?
Yes, they expect something like, in this range, we are speaking about 3 gigahertz, they expect something like 1,000 or 10,000 photons. Uh-huh. And this is possible to detect. So now, they want to operate, at least in this stage, they want to operate at 4.2 Kelvin. And now here, there are problems. Because at 4.2 Kelvin, if you calculate for 3 gigahertz, you expect an average of around 20 photons in a thermal state versus the usual half photon of the average. So you have to discriminate between 20 photons on your cavity will be due at 4.2 Kelvin to the fact that they leave at 4.2 Kelvin, and versus this, there is half a photon due to the ground state. Okay? You can say, okay, but let's operate at 10 millikelvin. Yes, you can do this. It's a little bit more complicated. You have to use dilution refrigerator. But the problem is that as you go down in temperature, you are also reducing the mobility of the carriers. And here it's important that these continuous shining pulses of laser, the semiconductor is recovering its state. So it's responding fast enough. And if you are going at 10 millikelvin, since the mobility for 3D carriers is scaling with the 3 over 2 of the power of the temperature, you are not longer able to modulate the effect at the same frequency. You have to go slower. And to go slower, it means that you have to use a longer cavity. But here is a kind of catch-22, because if you use a longer cavity, more photons from black body radiation will go inside, because you have a smaller h-bar omega, and then you have to go smaller in temperature. So this is a little bit an issue. Then this doesn't seem to be an issue so far, but on the other hand, they have not reached the quantum near quantum sensitivity. But in principle, when you shine on a semiconductor light, optical light, people these days are studying terahertz production in these semiconductors. So you expect also a tail probably in the gigahertz range. And in any case, all this physics has to be controlled as a background to claim that the photon is coming from the ground state. You can think, for instance, to sweep out the thermal photons just shifting suddenly the frequency, for instance, sending a first laser pulse to change the frequency. But whatever you do to the photons in the cavity, since photons, as everybody knows, are indistinguishable, is also occurring for the vacuum photon. In other words, unfortunately, there is no way to distinguish in the initial state of the cavity between the black body photons and the half vacuum photon. And so it's very difficult to go around. In any event, this is following the idea, that original idea, you have plasmon excitation more than phonon production, okay? Phonon excitation. So you produce photons through plasmons rather than phonon excitation. Anyway, this is the only experiment now in the world which is trying to see this effect, okay? And I'll show you here two pictures from the apparatus. This is a cryostat, and inside here there is a cavity. The most recent update on this experiment has been published in this paper in the spring of 2008, and they do expect to take data next year. So whatever is the result, stay tuned, because maybe that there is some interpretation, or we have to understand what is going on. We will get some signal. The issue is to understand how to disentangle for all these backgrounds, but this is the only experiment that is running so far. Now, the other route is still in the feasibility, at the feasibility project status, but I had further thoughts. I mean, in some sense, one can ask if this is the best way to get information on something like these effects. In some sense, the mechanical excitation of vacuum seems to be a very inefficient way to create. I mean, don't use that to produce some light, for instance. It's a very inefficient use of energy. Probably one may ask if you can get similar information using other effects in quantum medium in strong fields. Okay? After all, you can see boundary conditions as strong fields. I mean, to impose a boundary condition, a strong field, as Mera knows very well, can correspond to change a path integral, and then this can give rise to a sort of effective field. So there is a relation between claiming that you are studying quantum vacuum in boundary conditions or strong fields, quantum vacuum in strong fields. So there are a lot of possible candidates, like, for instance, to study photon-photon scattering and also its dynamics. So each of these is a phenomenon which in some sense has been studied or discussed in detail in the literature. You can also see transient phenomena of this one. In particular, you can also generate particles, not photons in this case, but electron positrons, through the Schwinger effect. Okay? And now there is a lot of focus on using high-power lasers or strong magnetic fields to study effects of this kind. In particular, Schwinger effect is almost within reachability with the next generation of high-power laser, both in the optical, like for instance the one that will run soon in Orsay, or for instance free electron lasers in the X-ray range, like the one facilities in Hamburg and so on. In astrophysics also, there are strong magnetic fields, in particular magnetars. They are also sources of soft gamma rays. And so now I'm trying to study collaboration, I mean, going very often to the Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge through sponsorship with the Julian Schwinger Foundation, to see if one can see some kind of physics related to the dynamics of quantum vacuum, like a Schwinger effect, in astrophysical objects. As you know, astrophysics is an entire jungle. You are just to study the object for what you want to look for. I mean, it's a rich, very rich kind of field, and many astronomers are looking to what you are asking to look for. So it's a really rich field. Oh, now, and this is all, I don't have to present data on the dynamical cousin effect. So there is this proposal, which is a follow-up of the idea and the estimates of Serge Renaud and Astrid Lambrecht, and this experiment which should run next year. Now, if there are no questions on the dynamic of Casimir at this level, or want to postpone, I want to go back and to do some final remarks on the two seminars, both facts or personal opinions, which can be relevant for the community. So the first, as I pointed out 2 days ago, is that the force is not tiny. Is substantial on microscopic scale. The issue is always to determine the distance and the scaling with the distance in particular. I also pointed out this other point, but this just, if you want, is semantic. You can call Casimir whatever you like to a certain extent, but nanotechnology is more dealing with the 10 nanometer, 100 nanometer range, and in that case, retardation effects don't appear. I believe, again, these are personal opinions, and you can balance with yours. But I believe that at the level of demonstrations, the situation, the current situation, is kind of satisfactory. However, as a demonstration, you should do some useful tools based on this demonstration. So if you don't enable some new technology, these demonstrations are a little bit not very impactful.
What are you referring to as demonstrations as opposed to experiments?
There was a slide in the last talk. You remember?
Yeah.
So, the experiment I'm interrogating nature. Okay. I want to disentangle between different hypotheses. Here I want to demonstrate an effect which I know already a priori in some sense. So the requirement, the statistical level of accuracy you need for a demonstration are more loose than for an experiment. If you want to see for new physics, everything should be under control at the level of precision required to see the new physics. And this was a slide I was pontificating on this 2 days ago. So that's I think that we need more experiments in a parallel plane configuration. By the way, the same Legnaro group has also an updated.
Can you specify why you want parallel planes? Is the amplification factor that you have the area?
Well, if you want to see for long-range physics, like thermal correction, they get more signal, okay? Then, when as discussed 2 days ago, we are finding that spheres have also their issues. It's not just here. The issue is the parallelization. Flatness is more or less under control these days and so on. So the issue, main issue is to parallelize the two plates. But in the other case, we have found all these problems of how much is uniform radius of curvature, and so on. So, and also there is a statistical fact that there are 6-7 experiments who took data in the sphere plane and only one in the parallel plate in the second generation. So it would be nice to have also experiments. I understand that it takes a little bit more of time, and so it's less rewarding on the short time scale, but you can get more from this because it's closer to the ideal situation. Then I was also discussing 2 days ago, it will be nice to check the use of proximity force approximation versus the exact approaches in what I call volumetric forces. It's my understanding, talking with Thorsten, that if you have any kind of force, volumetric, I mean not just limited like for instance in the case of conductors, the force between two surfaces, but even for bulky forces like gravitational one or Yukawa forces, it will be nice to check if PFA has the same degree of accuracy also in the case of these volumetric forces. It appears that as far as one surface is flat, it should be fine. We can discuss this later. It's very important to declare all the various issues and some of these issues, especially in the sphere plane or in general also for the cylinder plane, have emerged only recently. I think that the Yukawian limits should be reanalyzed after recent findings on possible systematic effects not taken into account. It will be great from my perspective as a final outcome of a Casimir measurement the product H-bar-C that we know almost exactly from the co-data, okay? So if you take the determination of H-bar, for instance, quantum Hall effect and so on, and you multiply by the determination of C, you get all these significant figures. So, and this is a common denominator to all the geometries if you use a Casimir, if you measure a Casimir force in parallel plate, cylinder plane, spherical plane, whatever geometry you like, at the end of the day you can express your measurement in terms of a measurement of this product. Since this is the exact value, basically exact, we will have a tiny error bar here, you can always express your final result with the central value and the error bar with respect to this. If there is new physics, or if systematic errors have not been taken properly into account, the central value will not coincide with this value here. And you can try to say something. And this is a kind of universal. I mean, all groups should confront themselves on this parameter in particular. I think, and these are now kind of suggestions for further studies. I mean, it would be nice to establish a link, in my opinion, between equilibrium thermal corrections in the Casimir force, still under debate, and non-equilibrium thermal correction already observed in the Casimir polder force with ultra-cold atom physics, as, for instance, the experiment that Francesco has sketched yesterday. Then this is what I was speaking a little bit before, that from some point of view, there's still a kind of nobody land between what we know about the dynamical Casimir effect and strong field physics, but both are dealing with creation of particles in vacuum. So there should be a more consistent picture merging the two together. The other thing, just to compensate the fact that I was kind of dismissive on the nano part, but these metamaterials, in principle, could be used to create slabs, a kind of Casimir. Imagine a cube where you cut inside a lot of slabs. Then what happens? That in principle, depending on the direction in which you are moving the object, you have different contribution of the electromagnetic mass, let's say. And so in principle you can end up with an object which has a mass tensor instead of having a mass scalar. And if you couple this with a torsional balance, this could also test the free fall of quantum vacuum, because if you see that the Wilson principle is also working for this, it means that also quantum vacuum follows the equilibrium principle. Okay? And yesterday I was just discussing with Mayer on this and being aware that there is already some discussion in one of your papers concerning lateral Casimir force and the possible inertial effect with different anisotropic in mass. So that's...
Is it not, don't you have not bounds on that from isotope effects in materials?
In what sense? This is a geometry effect.
Proton mass and neutron mass are different. Part of the difference of a proton mass and neutron mass is the self-energy of, the Coulomb self-energy effect. Basically one half is. And by studying different isotopes, you can map out this effect. You get, the alpha suppression. So basically, I think the best bounds on the weak equivalence principle are 10 to minus 13, something like this, at Watch group in Seattle. So you divide by 100 from 1,000, where you have your bound how good the electromagnetic self-energy follows.
You have to compare.
So this bound you will never reach with these experiments.
Mm.
You cannot even dream of reaching it.
No, but this is anisotropy.
Well,
no, but this already thing to the second part, to test the equivalence principle. And that is, what you are saying is definitely competitive with using a torsional balance with this metamaterial, which has a kind of an anisotropic geometrical structure and is blocking some of it. But the first part, these...
You can also make anisotropic metals with the isotope effect. Right? Using isotopes in one direction and then make it anisotropic.
I'm not sure that it can be realized with respect to use photonic materials or metamaterials. The idea that also if you move in one direction or the other direction, you have different acceleration for the same force is really... So then the other point I want to make is that it's important always when there is a Clemmer sensitivity to corroborate this with the experimental evidence that you are able to see a tiny effect at the same level. Okay? So I just give two examples. So if you claim that you see a piconewton force, so try to see an effect which is not exactly related to your physics in which there should be one piconewton signal. There has been a couple years ago, a paper in which they discussed what happens in, for a Casimir force when you apply an external magnetic field. And there are very tiny corrections. So in principle, you can express your sensitivity, if it's strong, high enough, mentioning the minimal. We try to apply an external magnetic field, and we have detected a minimal magnetic field of such a value. Okay, so it's always better not just to estimate the sensitivity theoretically, but also to look for a lateral effect, especially in the case of strong claims or sensitivity. The same, for instance, if you have, this is another experiment where they took different thickness of thin films, and they have shown a difference between the two cases in the related Casimir force. So you could, in principle, express also a sensitivity of your force measurement in terms of a minimum detectable difference in the film thickness. In any case, any effect which is sensitive to the Casimir force should help to assess the sensitivity. Also, there are issues with electrostatic calibration. Why not using other kind of physics to calibrate the apparatus? For instance, the Capasso group, they have worked recently using liquids, so they use fluidodynamic forces to calibrate the apparatus instead of electrostatic one. There is work by a group of Petrov in which he has used the radiation pressure, classical radiation pressure, the one on Lebedev, to calibrate, try to calibrate the Casimir apparatus. So we don't have to be stuck just with the Coulomb electrostatic, and it's better actually in the ideal world to check calibration with two different physics, like radiation pressure and electrostatic. And these are more kind of sociological, we can discuss, and maybe are more related to what you'll... But it's here there are some important points, because the community is a little bit, in some sense, out of track. It's important to share data, like in many other communities, and working now a little bit in astrophysics, it's wonderful that you can analyze data from any satellite on any telescope in that case. Okay, there is a time of delay, they take their time to do their first analysis, but then all the community, wherever you are in the world, you can access the data. Something similar should be here. I mean, if some people interested to reanalyze data with their idea or approach are interested to your data, you should deliver the data. This is important. It's also part of the problems miscommunication comes from the fact that very often one is writing a short letter, and then all the details are not made explicit by definition, because in a short letter you cannot elaborate on them, but then you should have an unlimited publication where you put almost everything, okay, so that people can understand. And obviously it's also important to have a workshop in which all people in the field are participating with an equal share of time instead of any fragmentation. And obviously it's important to have people not trying to oversell what they are doing, and in particular to have a very tight cooperation between people working in the lab and theorists which are very skeptical and critical. Having said so, there is still a lot of potential for growth, and there are a lot of possible bridges with many areas. Okay. This kind of research doesn't take a lot of money. You can do this on a very small scale, as you see from the number of authors, both for theory papers and experimental papers. They barely reach more than 10. And I found also personally, both in Padua and in Hannover, that is a very good training for people, for students, because they are exposed to theory, different experimental techniques, systematics, and so on. And this is just a wishful thinking, that especially considering that the community is growing, especially based on young people. But then if there are controversies in science, are important, obviously, but there should be scientific controversies, not clash of personalities and so on. And the field can be jeopardized if these controversies are involving young researchers at the point that they cannot even find a postdoc in another group, for instance. This obviously will discourage people, and it's in our interest to maintain the community alive from this point of view. Now, these are acknowledgement section. All that I spoke in these two seminars is also mainly based on work done first in Padova with Giacomo Bressi, Gianni Carugno, and Giuseppe Ruoso from National Institute for Nuclear Physics in Pavia, Padova, and Legnaro for the parallel plate configuration. There is also a project going on with Astrid Lambert, Serge Genoni, and Valerie Neriseschi in France to study with the torsional balance of the parallel plate. And for a cylinder plate configuration, we have collaborated with Fernando Lombardo and Francisco Diego Mazzitelli at Buenos Aires, and both for sphere plane and cylinder plane with Diego Dalvit. Diego, in particular, is a good example of how you can interact a lot between experimentalist theories. He's very curious. We spend very often hours on the phone, and we always get to learn something new. So it's almost an ideal example of how there should be collaboration between curious theorists and curious experimentalists and graduate students and collaborators at Dartmouth on all these projects, including also the dynamic Cousin effect. You have met Andy a few weeks ago, and this is the group in Dartmouth with two undergraduate students, Chung Wei, Andy Kim, and Michael Brown Hayes. For people interested to go more in depth, there is a recent review, a special issue in New Journal of Physics, free access, and there are many review papers, especially for the static Cousin efforts. Thank you.
Given that it's become clear that in the last 10, 15 years, there have been virtually no measurements that make the community happy as definitive measurements, why is one looking for much more difficult problems?
So
what you talked about today seems an order of magnitude more difficult.
Yeah, but it's a different sort of different physics. I mean, it's the dynamic of Cousin effect is.
The problems up already, they'll seem to propagate into here. Surface preparation, conditions, material properties that are idealized or not. Isn't there some lesson from the difficulty with the other systems?
You're referring to this talk, the dynamic of Cousin. No, I agree with you that there should be more emphasis on repeating some measurements for the Casimir, the static Casimir. I mean, these are what I spoke today are two proposals. There is don't know what to tell you exactly. I mean, I would like to have other experiments on the parallel plate. Okay. And more kind of calibrations for the sphere plane and so on, and this careful analysis with also the surface potential. So that's as you know, all the experiments have difficulties. So the partial exchange of information between people in the field due to the fact that not often you can see all the groups represented in the conference, I think is also responsible for sort of a slow progress from this point of view. In communities which are more compact from this point of view, like energy, physics, and so on, problems and issues are exchanged more quickly in some sense.
It's also not the fault of the people, because there are conferences like this QFext or whatever. I mean,
but do you see any QFext? Not all groups are participating, or vice versa, other kind of conferences. So,
something that bothers all of us.
I have another question about
I mean, there are probably concurrent setups, right? I mean, we have now the Casimir or the Lifshitz setup. There's a setup with Bose-Einstein condensates and plates. And there's a setup of the Heidelberg group with a Casimir Polder force. For instance, for if you really are after H bar C or getting high precision, probably this Casimir Polder setup is much better suited. Wouldn't you agree? Or after this, I mean.
If you want to, meaning we have already a measurement of H bar C, which is very precise.
Yeah.
That's not the issue. The problem is how to parameterize and compare different experiments on the same. On the same field, okay, on the same playground, and a possible way is to each experimental group is telling you what is the value of h bar c and what is the error bar on h bar c. This is my point, and if there is any discrepancy with respect to the quotation mark true value of h bar c, the one of codata, which is determined as you see with seven digits, you have to go back and understand why there is such a deviation. Because either you think that a macroscopic determination of h-bar-c is different from a microscopic determination like this experiment for some reason, because maybe quantum mechanics is different in macroscopic world, or which I don't trust, or otherwise there are either systematic effects not taken into account or new physics. This is my only point. No doubt that you can determine h-bar times c much better than these experiments. These are force-based experiments. So any measurement of macroscopic forces, as I was pointing out in the discussion during lunch, is going to be much worse than any microscopic determination based on electromagnetism. Just look at the Cavendish balance experiments for big G. I mean, even today, we know big G with something like 0.01% precision, not more. So this is a limitation of using determination of microscopic forces.
Among your astrophysical realizations, you didn't mention Hawking radiation potentially as an example.
Mm. Yeah. The relationship between Hawking radiation, Uru radiation and dynamical Casimir effect is a little bit confusing to me, in the sense that I do see a relationship between Uru and Hawking, if you want, through the equivalence principle, but Uru is different from dynamical Casimir effect, so in principle we are not looking to the same physics. You don't agree?
I don't agree. I mean, I have a picture in my mind and I see more the dynamical Casimir effect as a dynamical version of the Uru effect.
Again,
and when you're speaking of thermal field and the photon generated from the vacuum, I agree that there are some misunderstanding there. But in some sense, I'm not an expert, big expert on this, but I see that the radiation thermal field could be in some sense because of the non-uniform the dynamic of non-uniform acceleration. Could in some sense generate the photons you have in the dynamical Casimir effect. A bit like when you have a virtual photons around surrounding an atom, and you plug a laser, you make an experiment, and you can give those virtual photons energy, and those virtual photons could leave the virtual cloud surrounding the atom and becoming a real photon. And then the dynamic, the picture that I have, probably is a naive one, is that the Uru radiation, you have virtual thermal photons in sense surrounding the object, moving with a uniform acceleration. And when you change your acceleration, you are giving energy to these thermal photons in order to become real one.
Yeah, my view is different, but the fact that there are many different views means that something is confusing. Because in my view, the Uru effect is an apparent effect. I mean, if you are in an inertial frame of reference, you see a box moving with a uniform acceleration, you say that this box is moving, and there is there are virtual photons inside, etc. But if you are inside the box, you will see things as if there is
since the detector,
it's similar to have an apparent force, like a centrifugal.
The detector, in some sense, is feeling this thermal radiation. In principle, but that's the problem, you could detect this thermal radiation. So, I mean, if you detect, there is a sort of reality, but now we are going to philosophy, so...
No, because, I mean, if you are in an inertial frame of reference, you detect non-inertial forces. So, by the same principle, you can detect in a non-inertial frame of reference also things which are not, let's quote, real, that you don't observe in a inertial frame of reference. So, but yeah.
If you would have a rotating body close to a blackboard, then you would have your varying acceleration, right?
You would have.
It rotates when you have a component. I don't know if a fixed body has a constant acceleration, right? I mean, if you hover close to a black body, then I don't see that you have varying acceleration.
Unless you are very close to the Schwarzschild radius, the physics is very similar to any other self-gravitating object. I mean, you don't see any difference of being close to a black hole or not if you are not really within few radii from the Schwarzschild radius. So the trajectory is pretty much similar. I mean,
Okay. 12:30, 18 minutes, we'll speak about